10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of Kaylin Palomares, who arranges on a monthly basis for us to have an interesting guest and an interesting conversation about something related to the environment. And we have a great guest that we're going to introduce in just a moment. First, Kaylin Palomares, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg.
And you, for many years... Well, some years worked at Hawthorne Hollow, and very happily so, but not too long ago moved on to a position at Racine County. And I am very, very fuzzy on the details. Can you remind me and our listeners about what you do for Racine County?
Absolutely. So the position that I have now is conservation planner, and that's under the Land and Water Conservation Division for Racine County. It's a big mouthful. I am helping my... two colleagues would come up with conservation plans for all sorts of different things. We work a lot with agriculture and farmers. We also work with shorelines of the Fox River specifically, but a little bit of the Root River and all the lakes kind of to the western end of the county. So just kind of making sure everything stays where it's supposed to be and protecting our waterways. And
very good.
It's very fun.
That probably helps explain how you know Dr. Jim Studdy. Tell us exactly how the two of you met and what prompted you to want him to come on to the Morning Show today.
Absolutely. So Racine County works very closely with a producer-led group called the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. The Watershed Protection Committee is made up of a bunch of farmers from Racine County, but a lot of them are also farming in other counties as well. And they are all kind of on a mission to conserve their soil, conserve the waterways near their farm. And a lot of the ways that they're doing that is cover crops and no-till farming. And some of them do rotational grazing and things like that. So they all have different methods, and they kind of meet with each other to figure out what works best and how everybody in Racine County who farms can kind of preserve their soil or their water.
Great. So that explains the connection and, of course, also why this particular topic folds into the work that you do for Racine County. I mean, it's right at the heart of it.
That's right, yeah. So I'll be working with Jim probably a lot more as time goes on, I'm sure. But Racine County is kind of a partner with the Watershed Protection Committee.
Very good. So this is the moment that we actually extend the formal welcome to our other guest in the show today, Dr. Jim Studdy, former research director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute, now an independent researcher in this whole field. And the other thing that's so interesting about Dr. Jim Studdy is that he is also himself a farmer, actually more of kind of a part-time farmer, I think you were saying. And you also do a lot of work as a crop advisor to some of your fellow farmers. You're a member of the board of directors for what Kaylin mentioned, the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County, and are particularly interested in this thing called regenerative farming. And that's what we will explore for the next few minutes. So, Dr. Jim Studi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. Before we went on the air, we had the chance to chat a little bit, and I really appreciated the chance to get a little background on you, on where you are from originally, and the line of farmers of which you are a part. But it's kind of an interesting generation-skipping sort of thing. So tell our listeners a little bit about where you come from originally and your connection to the world and life of farming.
Sure. So I am, as I like to call it, a skip generation farmer. That's a way to skirt the issue of being a city boy. So I am on the family farm in the third generation. So my grandparents moved there in the 40s, and then my dad sought off-farm employment. So I grew up in the city of Madison, but I spent time on the farm as a youth and really got turned on to farming. And let's be frank, it was running equipment and that kind of thing. But back in Madison in high school, I got really turned on to biology, and in particular botany, plant biology. And I saw the connection with farming. And so I pursued undergraduate studies in agronomy at UW-Madison, and then I tried farming for a couple of years in the mid-80s. And as I say, I flunked out of farming, and it was a confluence of the bad farm economy at the time and just being poorly capitalized and a whole host of reasons. So I pursued graduate studies at UW-Madison, and then had the opportunity right when I was graduating to return to the farm. And so I did that, but in bootstrapping the farm, I also, knowing I had a very expensive education and the public investment and in my graduate studies, I needed to return to society. So I worked for UW Extension here in Racine and Kenosha counties for several years, went to the Michael Fields Institute, went to Extension again in Rock County, and then back to the Institute as research director. And for the past 5 years, have been an independent research agronomist based off my farm in the East Troy area.
Mm, great story. By the way, I hope this isn't too personal a question and just deflect it if you so choose, but I'm curious, you told me before we went on the air that your dad, who had no interest in farming, or at least not enough to be himself a farmer, I think you said became an attorney. And that's what took him to the city and so on.
Yeah, so not a practicing attorney. So he worked for his entire career as an attorney with the Legislative Council. So that's a branch of Wisconsin government. And he worked in the realm first of natural resources, but then moved into agriculture. And then, like a lot of people, got tripped up and he became the administrator. So he was the head of the Legislative Council. So what they do is they put together the study committees for the different bills and things. So he worked in relation to natural resources, but then agriculture. Providing the background information to the study committees.
Okay.
And
wow.
Then retired from that position and bought another farm in a different county. And he doesn't farm. He just he's got tenants on a farm, but he has implemented a whole lot of conservation practices on his farm to make it more environmentally friendly.
Great. So even though in some ways he looked like a city slicker, a lot of his professional life was kind of agriculturally adjacent, we might say.
Yeah, exactly.
And so my question was going to be, how did he greet the news of you yourself wanting to be a farmer? And I suspect he didn't have any problem with that at all. He was probably excited.
No, not at all. He was really excited about it, but of course, cautiously optimistic. He's like, just going with your eyes open. And my grandma too, who gave me the opportunity, she was the owner of the property at the time, and God bless her, she said, you fall flat on your face, you'll learn something there. And that's what happened.
Wow.
Here we are.
Great, great. In some of the research that you've done, aside from your farming, you were, as we mentioned earlier, for a time, the research director at the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. Could you just say a quick word about that? What is that, and what kind of research do they do, or what do they actually study?
Yeah, sure. So the institute itself, they're getting pretty close to celebrating their 40th anniversary. So they're in East Troy, and they work largely in the realm of organic agriculture. So it started as a spinoff of organic agriculture, which is biodynamic, but they focused more now on organic agriculture. And they've got three different program areas. So the first one is research, so providing research results and recommendations in the organic, primarily organic realm, addressing producers' concerns. The second is in education, and primarily they're an education, and their 501c3 charter says they are an educational organization. So it's taken the information from the research program and putting it into their educational programs.
Mm.
And then the third realm is policy, so trying to shape policy in the realm of conservation primarily. So shaping policy, they're a 501c3, so they can't lobby directly, but they will do grassroots organization to get support for primarily conservation programs. So like USDA programs, the CSP, Conservation Stewardship Program, the EQIP program, and also trying to get increased funding for the USDA's SARE program. So SARE, which funds my professional work, is SARE stands for Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. Mm. So it's all laudable, and it's all trying to increase funding for conservation work ultimately.
Fantastic. We're speaking with Dr. Jim Studdy, who is someone who is very, very interested in something called regenerative farming, which we're going to be exploring in just a second. He is now an independent researcher, but was for a time research director at the aforementioned Michael Fields Agricultural Institute. And he is also a member of the board of directors for the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County, which Kaylin Palomares was mentioning at the outset. And that's an organization that really intersects quite a lot with the work she does for Racine County. So explain a little more about the Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County. And I think you were telling me that that's a little bit of a misnomer, because in fact, it draws even participants from beyond the borders of Racine County.
Right. So we are one of the older producer-led groups. So right now in the state of Wisconsin, there's 47, I believe, producer-led groups. So what these are like-minded farmers who band together and were funded by a grant program administered by the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. So it's called a producer-led program. And so what they do is they fund our activities through a competitive grant program. And basically, we all do the same thing. We promote practices which, in theory, enhance soil health. So at the farm level, we're all about soil health. But then off the farm, what these soil health practices do is protect surface water quality. So they either protect it or improve it. So what we're trying to do is minimize the movement of soil and nutrients off the farm to surface water. And so we're like-minded farmers. We tend to be more innovative than conventional farmers. So we're looking at practices, production practices like no-till, like cover crops, and we take it maybe a step further, looking at installing pollinator habitat and buffers, which help prevent the movement off-farm movement of nutrients and sediment. Nutrient management is another key one, using nutrients in a most efficient manner possible for the same goals. And so what these groups do is we have educational programs, so we bring in guest speakers. We have, Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County, have a couple of formal outreach events annually. So we do have our Summer Field Day coming up at Case Eagle Park in Rochester. Mark your calendars, September 12th. That's on a Thursday. We're still working out the details of the program, but we'll talk about we'll provide an update for our research efforts that hopefully we'll be talking about in a few minutes here. We'll be having a soil pit where we'll talk about what soils look like and what soil health looks like in the soil pit, what it actually looks like. We're going to have a guest speaker, and his name escapes me now, but he's a regenerative farmer from outside of our region. And then to be determined. We're working on a program. But again, mark your calendar, September 12th.
So you were telling me before we went on the air that a lot of times when there is discussion about what we're going to be talking about today, it's often called sustainable farming, which is a perfectly fine term. But that you actually prefer the term regenerative farming. Explain why you think regenerative farming is actually a better term for what you as a farmer are all about.
Yeah, sure. So let's start with the definition of sustainable. So when I started farming 31 years ago, I consider myself a sustainable farmer. And the accepted definition of sustainability is that it's productive and profitable. So it meets our food and fiber needs of society, but it's also profitable for the farmer. The second leg, and I should have said this right up front, it's like a three-legged stool. And if you kick out any one of these legs, the stool falls apart. So it has to be profitable and productive. The second leg is that it conserves or protects the resource base that it's based on. So we're primarily talking about the soil. So we're protecting the soil. And then the third leg is that it's socially acceptable. Because if it's not socially acceptable, it's not going to be sustainable because society is not going to accept it and there's going to be pushback against it. And there's a whole lot of examples that are out there, but that I think is beyond the scope of what we want to talk about today. So it's the three legs, like I talked about, productive, profitable, conserves, and socially acceptable. I like the idea of regenerative farmer because it takes that second leg, conserving the resource base, and actually looks at improving it. So our goal in regenerative agriculture is to get back to where we were. We'll never get back to the way the soil was in a native situation because agriculture is it's a disturbed system. So we are going to be causing a stress on a system, but our goal is to get back as close as we can. So that is improving the soil condition, which includes increasing soil organic matter, which is really important, improving soil structure, which is really important for productivity, but also to mitigate the amount of off-farm impact that agriculture has. And again, that soil loss in the form of sedimentation, so that soil movement to the surface water, and also the loss of nutrients. And hopefully, as we focus on soil health by improving soil organic matter and improving the soil physical structure, we're also going to increase our yields. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to make it more sustainable over time.
Right. So sustainable, in a sense, the term sounds like let's try to hold things steady. Let's do this in a way that we can keep doing it, of course, and maybe adhering to kind of the status quo. Regenerative sounds like possibly even making something better.
Let's make it better.
Yeah. Kaylin Palomares is smiling and nodding as you're talking. I suspect it's because a lot of this, as we were saying, folds into the work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. We, at the county level, I mean, we have programs that allows a cost share situation with these farmers or landowners to put these practices into place so that It makes kind of financial sense for them to get started on some of these programs. And a lot of times, and Jim might mention this later, but a lot of times doing these conservation practices or this regenerative farming isn't an immediate benefit right away. You don't have an immediate, oh, like my farm looks, I have way more yield this year. I'm making so much more money this year on the first year. It just, it doesn't work like that. And so there's, we offer, and through other government programs, cost shares for the farmers so that if they want to put these practices in or if they want to, there's so much, but if they want to do any of these things, then there's kind of financial benefits to them for trying to conserve or put into practice the regenerative farming on their farm.
Right. So if it's, so it's often we're talking about a long-term benefit versus short-term, and maybe you can give assistance that helps them through that first part where it might come at more of a cost.
Yep.
For those of you just joining us, today is Kaylin Palomares' monthly visit to the morning show, and with her, Dr. Jim Studdy, who is himself a farmer and also someone who's done considerable research into something that he likes to call regenerative farming, sometimes called sustainable farming. And let's talk about a couple of the sort of the landmark planks of this kind of farming. And remind us once again, remind our listeners about the most important goals that are part of regenerative farming, and then we'll talk about the pathway to those goals.
So the at the farm level, the goal is soil health. So if you have a healthy soil, you're going to increase yields, hopefully, over time, and you're going to minimize the off-farm impacts of the farming. So we're reducing soil loss and nutrient loss.
And when you say improving soil health, what exactly is happening to the soil? I mean, what is the difference between healthy soil and not so healthy soil, apart from, you know, things don't grow as well? I mean, that's like a result of it being healthier soil. But when we actually look at the soil under the microscope, what does healthy soil look like versus not so healthy soil?
Yeah, so let's start with a definition. So, and this actually shows a change in the philosophy over time. So we used to talk about soil quality, and what soil quality implied was the physical state of the soil. So just going back to Soil Science 101, soil is made up of three primary particles, sand, silt, and clay. And those particles get glued together. And in this gluing together, we form what are called aggregates. And a quality soil has really good aggregates that are water stable. So what that means is that they hold together. And this aggregation imparts all sorts of wonderful properties on the soil. It increases aeration of the soil. It increases infiltration. So that's the movement of rainwater that strikes the soil surface into the soil surface instead of running off. If you have a well-aggregated soil, you get the infiltration. If your soil is not well-aggregated, the soil surface seals. And if you're on a slope, that water that hits the soil surface that can't work its way in runs off.
Just runs off.
And
okay.
It takes the particles with it. It takes the nutrients with it. It's looser. It allows for better gas exchange with crop roots. Crop roots respire like we do. They emit, they need oxygen, but they also release carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide needs to get away from the roots, otherwise it becomes toxic if it builds up. And then the last thing it does is it allows for the roots to grow easily into the soil. So it's not tight, the soil's not tight, the roots can grow better. Healthy roots mean healthy plants. So that's our goal. What soil quality totally ignores is the biological activity, and that's why everyone likes soil health. So there's a biological community in the soil, and we primarily think about bacteria and fungi. So they are the workhorses of soil health. What they do is they take fresh organic matter, they break it down. In the process of breaking it down, they release nutrients back to the system for the plants to take up. But their waste products also glue these particles together. And the fungi in particular produce a water-insoluble glue called glomalin, which gives soil that nice earthy smell. So you all know what good soil smells like. That's the primarily that's the glomalin. That's water insoluble. And so when water strikes the aggregate, instead of falling apart, that glue, this microbial, this fungal waste product, holds it together. So we continue to have the infiltration, gas exchange, and everything that we need. And then related to that is the next level of decomposers. So we've got earthworms in there that are burrowing, they're creating channels, more gas exchange, more water infiltration. We've got the arthropods, the predator beetles. There's a whole bunch of soil life. What we're trying to do is protect that. And how we protect it is we reduce tillage, because when we till soil, we destroy their habitat. And the other thing we do is we destroy the networks of fungal mycelia that that ramify or grow through the soil, and in particular, the mycorrhizal fungi. So what mycorrhiza means, it's a Greek word, and it means fungal root. So it's a symbiotic relationship between plant and fungus. So they physically attach to themselves. What the plant does in the symbiosis is give energy in the form of carbon and sugars to the fungus. What the fungus does is grow, and it explores a root volume much larger than what the plant roots could explore. It takes up nutrients and gives them back to the plant. When we till soil, we break up that network, and so we lose that symbiosis. So no-till is really important. The other thing we do in regenerative agriculture is we grow cover crops. And what the cover crops do is they protect the soil surface from raindrop impact, which initiates the erosion process, but they also return very physiologically young tissues to the system for the microbial community, the bacteria and the fungi, to feed on. And in exchange, it's a kind of a positive feedback loop. In exchange, they break it down, they release the nutrients, and they build up the soil structure in exchange. So it's very much a system. And those two practices, the no-till and the cover cropping, are the cornerstones of regenerative agriculture. Mm.
And when you talk about soil being healthy versus high quality, you're really touching on the fact that soil is a living thing.
I mean, it is a living thing
versus a living thing. And when you think of it, as you said, biologically, you're really getting at the heart of what is most important in great soil.
Exactly. And that also, this whole concept illustrates the sea change in how we've looked and viewed soil over time. So when I was a young undergraduate at UW-Madison back in the early 80s, soil was a medium. It was a rooting medium. It held the plant roots so that the plant could stand upright. It held water, and it held the nutrients that we applied. Fast forward 35 years later, all of a sudden, hey, this thing is alive, and the whole thing is a system, and we're thinking about biology. When I was an undergraduate, there was no such thing as a soil biology class at UW-Madison. In fact, I took the first pilot class in 1992, and now we look at it the other way. The physical part, who cares? It's soil biology.
Right. Wow. It's interesting to think about the drastic shift that's occurred in the field, so to speak, on a couple of different levels. Let's talk for a moment about no-tilling. So first of all, why have farmers tilled the soil? There had to be a reason. And what happens when you don't till the soil? I mean, in a sense, what happened to that initial reason for tilling the soil in the first place?
So initially, the reasons for tilling the soil were primarily to prepare a seed bed. So you wanted a loose soil, and tillage does loosen up the soil so that you could plant the seed. So that's part of it. The other part was to bury the existing crop residue, and that was related to the equipment that we had at the time. Early planting equipment just could not deal with crop residue, so corn stalks, what have you, on the soil surface. So we bury it, and it's gone, so we don't have to worry about it. And then partially related to that was to get it decomposed so it would release whatever nutrients were in there. The other component of tillage was for weed control, so mechanical weed control. So you get the crop planted, it's growing, you needed to control the weeds. And so in the home garden, we use the hoe. On the farm, we use the row cultivator. And so we physically disturb the soil to uproot the weeds or bury them. And that's how we gave the crop the competitive advantage to grow to maturity.
And so the problem is when you till, you're killing or destroying at least a lot of the weeds, but you're destroying other things that are beneficial.
Right. So you're disrupting the biology, but you're also breaking down the soil physical structure. You're attacking the aggregates directly. So in the short term, it looks like you're making a gain. Hey, look, this soil is all loose and friable. But you get one pounding rain on it, and all of a sudden you got concrete again.
Yeah.
So it becomes a futile cycle. So how do you mitigate that? You till again. You break down more aggregates,
right,
pounding rain.
Right.
So that's why we did it. So over time, two things happened. The first was the advancement in equipment, farming equipment. We could deal with the residue. We had heavier planters that could deal with the tighter soil. So, and it's the no-till planters. And currently, any planter that you buy in commercial agriculture is set up to no-till. So equipment is no longer an issue. Any farmer can do it with any brand new equipment that you're buying. And older equipment, like my equipment, I retrofitted it so that it could no-till. The other thing that happened was the advent of herbicides, which allowed us to control the weeds chemically, and so we didn't need to till the soil. So we could go off on a tangent and talk about the pros and cons of the herbicides. But one more point that I would like to make along the line here is we're also in the regen world. We are looking at using the cover crop, either the growing cover crop or its residue, to suppress weeds. So that's another way that we control the weeds, so we can reduce our reliance on the herbicide. So it's really advancements in technology that allowed us to no-till and no-till successfully. And there's really no barriers, physical barriers, for doing it now. I mean, we've got the technology.
Right. Now it's a matter of shifting attitudes for those holdouts, those farmers who can't quite get their heads around this new way of doing things. Let's talk a moment about cover crops and exactly what we're talking about. First of all, maybe give our listeners, especially the city slickers like me, kind of a definition of what we mean by a cover crop, and then maybe we can explore some examples of cover crops. But what does it mean when a farmer plants a cover crop?
So cover crop is really self-defining. So it's a crop that's grown when there's not another crop present, which covers the soil.
So it's some field where you're not at that time, you're not growing corn or you're not growing soybeans, you're not growing anything to be harvested.
Right. So it's during an open period in the growing season. So traditionally it's planted after the harvest of the crop. And so the whole idea is to cover the soil surface to protect it from the erosive forces of raindrop impact. So beyond that, just the cover crop and the cover cropping, this whole idea goes way back. And we have a long history in the state of Wisconsin, particularly in the Central Sands area of the state, where we grow a lot of the vegetable crops on the sandy soils, of growing the cover crops to protect the soil surface against primarily wind erosion. But we have learned that there's a multitude of benefits. And so we start looking at cover crops and selecting species based on benefits that we want. So one of the potential benefits is fixing atmospheric nitrogen. So biological nitrogen fixation to reduce the fertilizer bill. So we grow a legume. Legumes fix nitrogen with a symbiotic relationship with bacteria that set up shop in their roots. And so when the legume dies, it breaks down and that nitrogen gets released for the next crop. We can look at using them for nitrogen or nutrient scavenging. So when we have a stress year, and here in southeast Wisconsin, we've been in drought for the last 3 years. We don't take up all the nutrients that we've applied to our crops. So a rapid growing cover crop will take up those nutrients, hold it against leaching. And what leaching is the movement of nutrients, soluble nutrients, with water as it moves through the soil profile with gravity as it recharges the groundwater. If a nutrient's soluble and it's negatively charged, it'll move and it'll end up being in the groundwater. The cover crop can sponge or capture those nutrients, hold them in organic form. Ultimately, it'll break down with decomposition and hold it in the system, but release it to the next crop. So we can do that. We can use it for the weed suppression that we've talked about. And a great system that's evolved over the last 10 years is planting green. So we plant our current crop into, or our cash crop into a living green crop, and then terminate that crop at some point later on during the growing season. And what that cover crop does is it continues to grow, it continues to suppress weeds, accumulate biomass. And one thing we haven't really talked about, and that's on me, is it can sequester carbon. So we're capturing atmospheric carbon, we're tying it up in the soil. That's another huge component of regen agriculture, trying to capture carbon. Anyway, we decide to terminate that cover crop, so we terminate it chemically, and now those residues act like mulch, like we put on our garden crops, and physically or chemically suppress weeds. So, and there's a whole lot of other applications, other pest suppression, other pest interactions that we could do, but there's a whole lot of different benefits that we can get from the cover crop other than just protecting our soil. And ultimately, because we're adding more carbon, more organic matter back to our soil, we are improving or enhancing our soil biology because we're feeding them.
Right. Does it matter what the cover, what the cover crop is? I mean, does almost anything function decently well as a cover crop, or does it really need to be something fairly specific, I mean, and something that's maybe even designed or carefully selected to be a cover crop?
That's a very interesting question. And if we had a case of beer, we could sit here all day and debate this, but we only have a few minutes left. So let me just say this. Nature's cover crop are the weeds that are out there now. You can let the weeds grow and get some of the benefits of the cover crop as long as you don't let them go to seed, and some farmers use this strategy. But ultimately, the choice of cover crop is based on what the farmer wants to get out of them. And so we select based on what our goals are and what our cost constraints are. So it depends on, again, the goal and then species selection. But there's a lot of different species that are well adapted to our environment, to our short growing season, that can get the job done. It's just a matter of what do you want to do with it.
Right. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk for a second or two about another aspect of all of this in terms of doing farming in a way that's a little more earth-friendly. You were telling me about your exploration of green manuring, which involves, in a sense, reshaping our notion of what manure is. I mean, most of us have at least a rough idea of what manure means in terms of kind of the classic dictionary definition. But in fact, it is possible for farmers to move past that traditional kind of manure to something else. that can be a great enhancement to what you're doing.
Yeah, so the practice of agreement earring has been around for centuries. But let's think back about agriculture in Wisconsin 100 years ago. All farms were integrated. Every farm had livestock on it. So you fed the crops to the animals, the crops that weren't growing for direct consumption by humans. And then the animals produced the manure, which contained nutrients. And then that manure was applied on the farm fields, and then the crops took up the manure. So really, we were just recycling or cycling nutrients through the animals back to the farm. So it was a self-contained system, basically. And a huge component of that system was the symbiosis we talked about with the legume and the rhizobia bacteria, which fix the atmospheric nitrogen. So that's how we bring nitrogen into the system. So back around the post-World War II era, suddenly we started to see segregation where we had animal production, livestock production, which could have been dairy, could have been meat, so it could have been pork, beef, chicken, what have you, and then commodity production, corn, soybeans, and a little bit of wheat here in southeast Wisconsin. We lost that integration. It increased our need for synthetic nutrients, and in particular, synthetic nitrogen. And so we use synthetic nitrogen, which is made from natural gas, in our farming operation. The idea of green manuring is to capture that symbiosis, and through cover cropping with a legume green manure, we can reduce our reliance on the synthetic form of nitrogen and ultimately cut our fossil energy use by the green manuring. So that's one of the strategies in cover cropping. And what it looks like on the farm, so right now, driving here to the studio today, I see that winter wheat harvest has started. So we've used about half of the growing season. Winter wheat is harvested. We've got half of the growing season left. Let's plant a diverse cover crop mix on that field, which includes the legume, to fix nitrogen for next year's high nitrogen demand corn, like high demand crop like corn, and that legume's going to reduce our nitrogen fertilizer bill next year. But let's also think about fixing carbon. So let's have a rapid growing warm season species in there that's going to grab a bunch of carbon and store it in the soil. And let's have all sorts of things in between to make the diverse, to make the mix more diverse and do some of the things we don't even know what some of these diverse species are doing. But we've got different root architectures. So we got a taproot to break up compaction. We've got fibrous roots to break up the really tightness of the soil. We've got deep roots. We've got shallow roots. So let's make a system that exploits all of the interactions that are possible between plants and the soil to improve the soil.
Fantastic. I know that some of the research that you are doing is on your own small farm and also at Case Eagle Park in Rochester. Real quick, we just have a couple of minutes left. What's kind of the nature of that research? I mean, is it as simple as just planning something and looking at it and seeing what happens? Or what kinds of questions are you trying to answer, or what kind of new information are you trying to unearth in the research that you're doing on your own farm and in Rochester?
So my professional research is all done in the context of no-till. I am looking at cover cropping and the cause and effect. So I'm looking at the impact of the cover crop on the crop yield and its economics. We know from the social sciences that farming is a business. And if we can find a profitable system with the cover crops, that everyone is going to be doing it because it's going to be a business decision. Mm. So I'm looking to identify best management practices in the cover crop phase to make it to have the biggest impact on crop yield. So professionally, that's what I do. Our group at Case Eagle Park, so through the foresight of the county board in Racine County, our group has the lease of 50 acres of cropland at Case Eagle Park. Our keystone enterprise out there is a direct comparison of conventional as practiced agriculture here in Southeast Wisconsin with the best of regenerative.
Like side by side.
Side by side. Randomized, replicated research trials, so it meets all the rigorous requirements of true scientific research done with field scale equipment. We're making the comparison. We are in the third year of our comparison. We're making the comparison based on economics. So we're looking at production economics. And we know that one of the major barriers to conservation adoption is the fear of transition. So there's a fear of a transition period. We don't know exactly how long it is, but we think somewhere in the range of 3 to 5 years, you have reduced crop yields. But then suddenly the system will start to respond to it. The problem, and we call this the least problem, in Wisconsin, in Southeast Wisconsin, 50% of our cropland is on leases, so it's rented. Guess what? Most of the leases are 3 years. So if I'm losing yield for 3 years, I'm losing income for 3 years, I'm improving the soil, someone else could come along, take that land away, outbid me, and then they're going to reap the benefits. So we're trying to define what that transition period is and then what's the benefit beyond there. So we're making the comparison based on economics, but we're also looking at what's the changes in soil health. And this is exactly what I'm going to talk about at our field day again, September 12th. Mark your calendars, Case Eagle Park. Call Chad at the extension office. Seriously, so to find the information on our group, all you have to do is a quick search, Watershed Protection Committee of Racine County, and you'll see what we're all about and find out about our field day, but also our winter workshop and other activities that we have.
Fantastic, fascinating stuff. And sometime we need to have you back to talk about the whole psychology of this. That is, it's one thing to be a bunch of like-minded farmers, but how about those farmers who are not like-minded, who have yet to be persuaded, and what's involved in that? And in what ways do we work with farmers, to kind of bring them aboard on some of these practices? And I know that's something that is of great interest to you. And so someday we'll have a follow-up conversation about that as well. Dr. Jim Studi, it's been great to have you here. Thank you for all the interesting information that you shared. And thank you for all you're doing to make the world a better place. And thank you for being the Morning Show guest today.
This was great. Thank you.
Glad you enjoyed it. Kaylin, I know you have a couple of announcements for us.
I do, but really quick before that, I just want to say if anyone can't make it to that field day, out at Case Eagle Park, there's going to be some educational signs put in by yours truly and with Jim's approval to kind of explain that entire process, and you can see it in front of you while you're learning about it. So coming up in the next few weeks, those should be up. So if you're out there taking a walk on the bike path or you're visiting the dam, anything, there's going to be some signs out there.
Excellent.
So,
great idea.
Back to announcements. So, obviously, tomorrow is a Friday night in Summers, which means it's going to be a concert at Hawthorne Hollow. So, the band Trip, it's a rock band, will be there tomorrow night. Gates open at 5 p.m. and it starts at 6. It's $10 per person, cash only, and bring your own chair. Again, that's at Hawthorne Hollow. And then Greg gave me this little note here. So there is a freshwater fun day at Pets at the Petrifying Springs Beer Garden on Monday, July 29th. There will be a touch table. People can see aquatic invertebrates and other life. There will be stories and crafts and all sorts of fun, cool things for the family. So check that out as well.
Very good. And we have an upcoming morning show about that with Anna Static from the UW Parkside Library that are kind of a partner organization for that. So, Kaylin Palomares, thank you for bringing in a blue ribbon guest today for today's morning show. And we look forward to your further visits to the program.
Thank you.
Kaylin Palomares from Racine County. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio momentarily. And we want to first talk about the weather for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. It contains a lot of sunshine and some beautiful temperatures. Sunny today and pleasant, a high of 76 degrees. Clear overnight, a low of 55. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 79. About 83 for a high on Saturday, again with partly sunny skies. Very similar forecast on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday. We do have by Wednesday of next week a chance of some rain. But for the most part, we have a relatively dry and very, very pleasant situation weather-wise here in southeastern Wisconsin. We have Wisconsin Public Radio programming coming up next. David Grath will be back with an update of the news at noon. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, WP.